Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Welcome to this Friday edition of Film Spotting. On today's show, the top five character actors who should be in every movie, listener feedback, music by Nico Case, but first, Cobra Verde, the final collaboration between Werner Herzog and Klaus Kinski. This time, Kinski gets to play a maniacal slave trader.
No way. A maniac, Klaus Kinski.
Believe it or not.
He does play a Brazilian mine worker turned bandit turned African slave trader who comes dangerously close to being beheaded and eventually leads a revolt against one of the territory's tribal kings. And Sam, Cobra Verde is, as you noted, the fifth and final film collaboration between Herzog and his volatile star, Kinski, who would die of a heart attack less than 4 years later. Conventional wisdom says that this is the worst film of the five Herzog-Kinski films. Care to disagree?
Yes, I would, in fact. Strangely, and I really don't think it had anything to do with the fact that, you know, we heard from a number of listeners who said, you know, leave it off the marathon. It's not even worth seeing. The fact is, I think this is my favorite film of the series.
You are kidding.
Yes, I'm kidding. No, I'm not kidding. I really loved it. Somehow, you know, last week when we were talking about Fitzcarraldo, I was talking about the fact that I was getting kind of fatigued by Herzog's myth-making. And, you know, and the fact that I was never quite taken, I never quite went on his journey. And, you know, that really a lot of his films, I think if you'd ask him, a lot of his films are about tone, about really capturing a tone in some way and really going for the ride in that way. And Cobra Verde is the only film really where that successfully took place for me. You know, where I've admired a lot of the other films in the series and a lot of things about them, this one, and I remember sitting there and realizing I was taken away by it. And it really, the first 20 minutes or so were really, you know, really hard to get a handle on as we get sort of the prelude to Kinski's, you know, becoming this slave trader, as you mentioned, working in a gold mine, and we're not even sure where they are, and you know, by the time we get situated. But it was interesting. I mean, Kinski, it was really, I started thinking about the proposition. You know, Kinski's character, you know, the bandit Cobra Verde, is frequently treated as this sort of mythic character, this terrifying figure, mm-hmm. Before we're really introduced to him. Or not so much before we're introduced to him, but while we're getting to know him, before we really know anything about him. Which is, you know, very much the way that Hillcoat treats the character, or Nick Cave treats the character, played by Danny Houston in The Proposition. And the fact is, like, we get, you know, villagers running screaming with just the sheer sight of Kinski, which I'm sorry, you have to admit is just all too believable and may have just been documentary footage.
He's here.
Here he is with a rifle. So yeah. He just woke up. He's in a bad mood. But I think part of it is the fact that we're seeing it. This is the end of the marathon, and we understand, I mean, everything that, the way that Herzog has used Kinski throughout the marathon as this figure, you know, and really this is where Kinski sort of famously lets loose. I mean, he is a wild man, mm-hmm. and I think there's always, in the previous films, that's sort of been repressed and effectively used. There is a moment late in the film, and believe me, this is actually a scene where he is training 1,000 Amazon women fighters.
African women.
African, well, as Amazons. I mean, he's okay. Created, I'm sorry, I misspoke, but he's training an army of Amazons, which are African tribeswomen.
Yeah.
And there is a moment where he's teaching them how to use a spear, and he is absolutely looks like a terrifying maniac.
Yes.
But the fact is, like, part of that is what worked about it for me, was really the culmination of everything that Herzog, and I know Herzog sort of doesn't even think this is all that good a film, but somehow it's the culmination of everything he tries to do or has tried to do in the previous films worked for me here. The whole mythic tone of it worked. I mean, part of it was just the way it looked. I mean, it was a little bit glossier than the previous films too, and it's beautifully photographed, and part of it was the scale. I mean, there really were, I mean, he's always using, you know, the locale. I mean, Herzog's always been using the locale and the people that live in that locale. But I think they're most effectively used here, where there's just teeming with people, and you really get a sense of a place more than the other ones. Where it's, I don't necessarily see Herzog capturing it as much as I'm just experiencing it.
No, I disagree completely. I never felt like the character the place they were in, that nature was a character in the film like you get in the other films. And unfortunately, I think Herzog believes this is subpar work for him, because it is subpar work for him. I hate agreeing with conventional wisdom, but this was by far the least satisfying film that we've seen. The other films were really built around great, simple plots, characters that have clear goals that are really on missions. If you think about all the films we've seen, characters have a goal, an end goal, a mission they're on, and everything that goes wrong around it. And here you sort of get that, where he's been dispatched to Africa to go talk to the kings, the local kings or whatever, and then work out some arrangement to bring slaves back. But it gets so...
Well, largely, he's been sent to die, in
fact. He has been sent to die, actually. But it gets so cluttered along the way. Things get too big, too many characters, too much plot. There are whole parts of this movie, Sam, that don't make any sense. Characters, like, changing their complete worldviews and motivations in the blink of an eye that don't really make sense, including our main character, Cobra Verde. And I just could not ever get into the story because it was so... frankly, incoherent. I mean, you're not into the myth-making that Herzog's after. Apparently, you don't mind lacking coherence.
Utter confusion,
because that's what I felt watching this movie. And unfortunately, the visuals here, you can always rely on Herzog to have the visuals to compensate. And here, I don't think they're enough. The flattest compositions we've seen of any of his films so far, the least amount of camera movement, and there are a few great shots that echo kind of Aguirre. The shot we talked about at the beginning of Aguirre, seeing the people descending down the mountain and just being in awe of how many people there are, and the way the shot actually sets up that feeling of awe, the way it's framed, and how long it holds there. Here, you get a few of those. There's this shot of this endless string of slaves going to the ocean, which is breathtaking in a number of ways. Breathtaking in its beauty somehow, and breathtaking in its horror at the same time is what makes it so effective. And there's also a scene near the end where, same thing, there's this kind of telegraph process going on where they're communicating by this endless string of Africans waving white flags. And you talk about scale. You can't believe how long this is, and it's so amazing to watch. But those moments alone visually aren't enough to compensate for the lack of coherency that I found in the film otherwise. And I have to say, too, that the biggest thing, too, we've always had to rely on in these films, if things didn't work, we always had the visual artistry of it, and we always had Kinski's performance to revel in. And here, Kinski, unfortunately, you can tell he's at the end of his string. He's just plain bad here, I think.
Really?
He's just plain bad.
Oh, I think he's totally... And I know, you know, reportedly, it was really like trying to contain a tsunami here with Kinski, and it really was like a terrible, terrible shoot, even compared to the other famously difficult shoots. But for me, he's, again, totally fascinating to watch. And I really just, there were a lot of little things that worked for me just throughout. I mean, part of it, I totally agree. The fact is, you don't have the momentum of a single character striving for something specific. That is not clear. It's true. But I think it occurred to me a number of things that I've learned to appreciate about Herzog and what he does. There's a scene early on where the crazed Kinski is sitting on a porch, on a sugar plantation owner's porch with his three daughters, sipping tea barefoot with his, you know, he's overdressed in some way. He's completely uncomfortable. He's sipping this tiny little thimbleful of tea.
Uh-huh.
And the girls are making fun of him. And you realize, like, the power of knowing that at any moment he could just crush their skulls and eat them alive. You know, and it's like, the fact is, though, I have come to trust Herzog. He's never going to just give me a scene of surprising violence just for the fact to do it.
No.
And I realized that I had a sense of like trusting him as a director, knowing he wouldn't do that, and also realizing that my instinct to fear that was that so many directors do that. So many filmmakers just do that, and you learn to expect it, and it's sort of an awful thing. You come to expect it, and it's sort of an uncomfortable thing to have to sit through. And the power of his restraint there is really effective. Also, just the fact of the story of the crazed, you know, king or prince of the African tribe who is insane.
Yeah.
The fact is, that just worked on a really relevant level. It's just like, just the way, I mean, just if you look at, you know, the chieftains of Africa now, of the tribes of Africa now, there's that sort of thing is going on. And North Korea, I mean, it's just like there are crazed monomaniacal leaders that the way he captured that was a way that I feel like in other films of his, I wasn't quite going on that journey with him in his depiction of mania. And this, it totally did work for me.
No.
And the final shot was, for me, just as effective
It's very powerful.
As watching Fitzcarraldo's boat enter the water. It is really
Sisyphus-like struggle.
It really is amazing. Like yeah, it, I felt the most moved, honestly, by that scene of any scene in the entire marathon.
Really, I did like the end scene, and I see how it ties in with the larger body of work that we've watched so far. But really, I have to go back to Kinski here. For the first time, I praise this about Fitzcarraldo. I realize that what I liked about him so much is that he's someone who's always larger than life. He's always someone so big, but he's always so subtle in the process. He never has to convince you that he's big and tough and that he's a leader. He just is that way. You're drawn to him. It's a natural sort of charisma that really few people have, and Kinski has it. And here, I really felt like he was almost playing a caricature of himself. He's trying to be a badass. The movie needs him to be this tough, awe-inspiring, fear-inspiring character, and he just cannot pull it off. The subtlety and the restrained kind of part of Kinski's nature that we always see of his acting, it's completely gone, and he's all over the place. You talk about that shot where he comes out with the rifle and people run. It doesn't work because Kinski is sneering and he's big and he's obnoxious. He's actually trying to play up the fact that, hey, run from me. We don't need that from Kinski. I've never needed it before. 10 years ago, Kinski wouldn't have had to do that. He wouldn't have had to act that part.
10 years before this film was
exactly.
Made.
He wouldn't have had to play that part the way he does. He's not here. He's too big. Kinski, for the first time in this marathon, overacts. And I actually feel like a case could be made, it occurred to me, that people talk about Herzog and the way he exploits nature and actually making his films probably destroys a good part of nature in the process, exploiting it in order to get his films made. And here's the one case so far where I actually felt like rather than being exploitive of nature, he was exploiting people. And he was namely exploiting Kinski. I felt like maybe
interesting.
He was actually shooting Kinski the way he was with these awful close-ups and Kinski overacting in those close-ups, almost as a way to revel in showing Kinski at the end of his string. He was really taking a perverse kind of pleasure in showing Kinski be bad. And even at the end of the film, too, it's not just Kinski. There's this segment at the end that feels like Herzog's trying to match something out of a National Geographic documentary where these young African girls come out and start singing a song. I felt like there he was actually exploiting them in a way.
I did too.
That was the first time where Herzog, I felt, was trying to put something in the film that felt documentary-ish just for the sake of it. Like, hey, I'm capturing life in Africa. Whereas in all the other movies we've seen, those moments felt so natural and felt like they matched the overall eerie tone of what was going on. And here it's like, that was like, well, I'm Werner Herzog and I shoot nature and here's people acting normal in nature. I'm gonna give you like 5 minutes of this. I felt like he was actually using them.
Yeah,
in a way.
And I don't know if it would have bothered me so much or it would have bothered me more. The fact is that I loved the performance that those girls were giving.
Sure.
The music was just amazing and I think contributed for me to the whole tone of the movie. But I wanted to say too that the subject matter, strictly the subject matter of slavery in some way, I was thinking about how effective it is in his depiction of it, because what he gives us that I don't think any other film gives us is a simple, awful fact of slavery without commenting on it, without, you know, talking about like, here's the beauty of this place and here's the irony of the fact that here's the very worst of mankind enslaving each other. He, for me, was, I mean, it's not like Kinski's character is necessarily sympathetic, but he is a slave trader, and yet we are understanding who he is and his motivations, whatever they may be. And for me, it was moving because here's a filmmaker just giving us the fact of slavery in a way that is in no way manipulative in a way that's somebody he's
and
giving a commentary
on. It's actually off-putting. It's off-putting, right, because he chooses not to comment
on
it. And maybe I was a little too put off by that. I just really feel that not only is Kinski bad here, but the character of Cobra Verde is the most uninteresting character we've seen in all these films. He's always been somewhat sympathetic. Even when he's playing a vampire, he's been somewhat sympathetic. Yeah. And as Aguirre, he's not sympathetic, but he's so subtle and just naturally menacing that you're drawn to him. You can't take your eyes off him. You want to know. You don't sympathize with him, but you want to know what he's going to do next. This guy here is a blank sheet. I had no idea what his motivations were at any point, and I found nothing interesting about him. I didn't.
My favorite movie of the marathon.
The worst one of the marathon by far.
All right. Well, next week we'll finish the Herzog-Kinski Marathon with Herzog's 1999 documentary, My Best Fiend, about his relationship with Kinski, sort of getting the last word here on Kinski, who had died 8 years previous. And then we'll gear up for the next marathon, Screwball Comedies. For more information on that, go to filmspotting.net and click on the marathons link.
Last week we gave our top 5 movies of the year so far and performances of the year so far. After the break, we'll get to your picks. Stay with us.
Darling, oh my darling, how can you forget all the love we had between us? Now it's like we never met. Oh, it kills me. How it kills me. When I think how hell you are. But you were golden. I was blind. With your poison in my blood. Bittersweet are the memories that make young lovers part. But I treat all the memories just to have your heart in mind.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and before we jump into the mailbag, Sam, I did want to mention some voicemails we've received recently we don't have time for to play on the show, but we got a nice email from our friend Mark in Atlanta with some top five feedback. We were wondering about whether or not people want to hear kind of our real choices sometimes, even if they're a little bit cliche, or they'd rather hear us bring up movies maybe they're not as familiar with. He weighed in on that, as other people did. Justin Pearl in Alliance, Nebraska mentioned, Sam, actually it's to me, engineers blow the whistle. You were talking about the hype train. You were the conductor.
I wanted to be the conductor
of the Nacho Libre hype train.
Interesting.
He pointed
out
he works for a train company, something that's train related, and engineers blow the whistle.
So I still want to be the conductor.
You can be the conductor.
I'll give the signal to the engineer. Blow the whistle.
There you have it. Carmen Van Kirko mentioned chick flicks, Dolores Claiborne, Repulsion, and the Joy Luck Club. Mm. The Joy Luck Club was begrudging, she mentioned, but Repulsion was great because that was a former overlooked DVD pick of mine, and she actually sought it out and loved it because of my recommendation, so that's nice. And lastly, we do just want to thank Cleveland in Brooklyn, who was just congratulating us on the Chicago Public Radio gig, and we appreciate everyone who has sent in emails and voicemails about our first show, and we'll talk about
that here
in a little bit during this segment, some notes about our first Chicago Public Radio edition of Film Spotting. We also want to mention real quick the Podcast Awards. This is a website called podcastawards.com, and you can nominate different shows in different categories. You get five nominees, and then there is a winner named at the end. And we're bringing this up because last year we were nominated, and we ended up not winning.
Right.
We lost to, I think, a Star Wars podcast, TheForce.net. And the funny part is, it was great that we got nominated without ever mentioning it. We never put a link on our website. We never brought it up on the show. And this time we thought we might as well go ahead and mention it. Saturday, July 1st, the voting starts. If you'd like to go over and nominate us for an award in the movies category, that would be fantastic. Please go ahead and do it.
We also have a survey request. There's a new survey on our website, which you can find by clicking on the banner at filmspotting.net. The survey is to help us gather information on your opinions on podcast advertisements. Please answer the questions honestly, as it will help us to provide the best podcast possible.
Absolutely. And one thing we didn't get to on Wednesday's show, Sam, donations. We need to thank the people who were so generous as to go to filmspotting.net and click on the PayPal link and throw a few dollars our way. We, of course, got sidetracked because of our long-winded reviews and our battle
over the Lake House. The lost Civil War conflict.
Uh-huh. They will call it that, I'm sure. And so we want to thank those people.
That's right. We want to thank Virginie, Last Wonder of the World, Derek, Illusion of Grace, and Richard, the Sandbox Tsunami, for donating this week. Thank you so much, the three of you.
We do appreciate it. I just want to throw in, just to cover our bases here, that even though it is spelled with an E at the end, I think her name's probably Virginia.
Virginia. Oh, is it Virginia?
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing.
I believe Virginia is writing in from France.
I think she is. So I could be wrong.
She'll correct us.
She'll correct us. I hope she does. We want to be right. We got some other interesting notes kind of in response to some things that have been going on Film Spotting lately, like we mentioned, the WBEZ Chicago Public Radio show. We'll get to that in 1 second. But we also got this email from Jen in Chicago, and I don't know how many people caught this. We did put it in the notes, Sam. This one is from Jen. Hey, Adam and Sam, I just finished listening to the outtake at the end of episode 104, and I have to know, what else have we been missing all this time? I doubt I'm alone in saying this, but I'd love to hear other outtakes. They could be extras on the website or put together as a compilation episode next time you have technical difficulties brought on by Sam's jet set lifestyle. I'm not picky. Cheers, Jen in Chicago.
What is Jen talking about? What outtakes? This, you're hearing an unedited version of the show. What? This is, we're not creating the illusion of live radio. This is live radio. Uh-huh. There are no outtakes. I pronounce every foreign word as it should be pronounced.
Yeah. This is the outtake you may hear at the end of this show sometime, if I haven't already used it by the time you hear this show. Sam's pronunciation during Nacho Libre.
Encarnacion.
And trying to pronounce the name of the actress along with her name, Ana de la Reguera, with Sister Encarnacion.
Too much for me to handle.
Literally, it's like 2 minutes of airtime. It's like 2 minutes of airtime of Sam stumbling over that name. So yeah. Anyway, it could be fun to get to that. Maybe I will let you hear that at the end of a show, throw that in. But yeah, we did throw in an outtake at the end of 104 that was pretty funny. It was me reading a listener's response to X-Men, the line about calling X-Turd an X-Turd.
It just
cracked us both up. And the funny part is, if you listen to the outtake, Sam, is that you're kind of backing away from the mic. And so it kind of just sounds like I'm laughing at
you're
myself.
All alone.
When the fact is, like, I'm cracking up because I was dying laughing.
It's true.
And it was actually kind of fun. And I said to you after that segment, I was like, that could be an outtake.
And it
maybe
was.
We should throw that in. And so we hope a few of you enjoyed that. And you may hear some more outtakes from time to time. You got to listen through the end of the show. We also got this one, Sam. I'm going to let you read it from Steve in LA with a little bit of criticism we feel like we need to address.
Absolutely. Steve writes, longtime listener, second or third time writer. I really love what you guys do week in and week out. But the Chicago Public Radio version should be just that, for radio in Chicago. The re-airing of old shows and the constant clips from movies made this podcast hard to listen to. I understand why you did what you did, but I think you should just create the one show per month for radio and radio only to deviate from your normal format for a new radio audience doesn't really fit for those who have been listening to you from the early days of your podcast. Keep up the great work. And that's Steve in LA.
Yeah. And a few listeners wrote in with this similar complaint. And the fact of the matter is, as I mentioned in last week's edition of The Dope Sheet, so if you have subscribed to that, go to filmspotting.net. You can get that every week. I did mention in the email blast that that was an odd show. We want to address this on the show, but it really was an anomaly. It was because it was our first show. We had to throw it together kind of quickly. We decided it might be fun to go back and include some excerpts of previous reviews, Night Watch and Three Burials.
Particularly
were just
something
out.
So relevant a as Prairie Home Companion. Yeah.
You know, that was specifically because it was a week before our NPR debut, the Chicago Public Radio debut. We thought it was perfect for that audience. But actually, I laid out the format for our next show in July on Chicago Public Radio. You're going to get another four-segment show, but we're going to review two new movies that opened that weekend, Lady in the Water and Clerks 2. We're going to have a special guest that we haven't announced yet. We're going to have our first film spotting interview with a filmmaker on the show. And we're also going to get into our top five, which for that week will be top five male bonding movies. So it's going to be more like a normal show than what you got last time with WBEZ. So
we talked about like creating some original content for the podcast version of what was the BEZ version content. We decided really let's put the BEZ show out there for podcast listeners to listen to so we could get your feedback. Mm-hmm. Honestly, that was part of our agenda. And we got it, and we thank you. And I think we learned a lot from the experience. And next time out on BEZ will be different, largely thanks to you guys.
Absolutely. Well put, Sam. Let's get on to some Nacho Libre feedback. That is the movie we reviewed. Perfect for our public radio debut, Nacho Libre here.
Perfect, really.
And we got this from Seth in Fort Lewis, Washington. Really, guys, you think Nacho Libre was competently directed? And again, we were very negative. We both gave this movie, you know, a bad review. But he says, I'm curious if both of you use that phrase. You're willing to go that high with your praise? I don't want to pick on the guy too much, but Jared Hess's direction is awful. It's the worst thing about the film. Almost every shot, with the exception of the action moments, is a one shot with the subject dead center. And I don't think this is a stylistic choice. I think that's how Hess thinks you're supposed to shoot people, especially when they're supposed to be emoting or doing something funny. An off-center composition? Never heard of it. Long lens? Never heard of it. Camera movement? Probably not necessary. I think Hess benefits from excellent production design and, during the wrestling sequences, some admittedly quite good, quite realistic fight choreography, but I don't think we should go out of our way to give the director too much credit for those things, as the rest of the film doesn't suggest that they are guided by some all-encompassing directorial intelligence. Well, Seth is right. I don't think we thought the film was very well directed, but my point was, in terms of bringing up the term competence, is that I do disagree with
Seth.
Which
is not a raving.
No, but I do disagree. I think that these are very clear stylistic choices, and they are. Some people wrote in and were surprised that we were comparing him at all to Wes Anderson. Those things that Seth mentions in there, the dead center compositions, that no camera movement, that's a lot of choice. That's Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
And that is a choice that they both make. And I think that Jared Hess has probably seen enough movies to know how most people shoot a film, and he's making a clear choice whether or not it works. I think his direction is more ineffective in terms of just the way he handles the story and chooses to put it all together. But in terms of his direction, there are Wes Anderson overtones there, and I give him the credit of making choices.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to our credit, I mean, we pointed out that this, if anything, I mean, I don't think you can deny the fact that he is inspired in some way by Wes Anderson, but that he doesn't come close to achieving what Wes Anderson achieves, even in his less good films.
True. Okay. Well, we've got some great top five of the year feedback, Sam, so why don't you go ahead and kick this one off here. Dakota in Nashville.
Dakota in Nashville writes, I have been waiting for months now for at least a mention of what I feel is not only one of the best films of the year so far, but also one of the best music docs I've ever seen. Of course, I'm talking about Dave Chappelle's Block Party. This is like the last waltz of hip-hop. Dave Chappelle is funny and heartwarming. Michel Gondry crafts some amazing shots, and all of the music is amazing. I'm afraid that you and others stayed away from it because of a dislike of mainstream hip-hop that you see on MTV or hear on the radio. That is unfortunate, since Mos Def, The Roots, Dead Prez, Common, Erykah Badu, etc. have more musical and artistic talent than all of the Grammy-winning artists of the last year combined. This is not music about bling and bitches. This is socially conscious art. Hip-hop music is just as diverse as rock. I highly recommend that everyone see Dave Chappelle's Block Party, my number one film of the year so far.
How about that? I've been really anxious to check it out on DVD. And if I remember correctly, Sam, it came out the same weekend that Night Watch came out. Wasn't it Night Watch?
It was Night Watch. You're
wanted,
right.
I lobbied. We put up a poll question. We asked what listeners wanted.
And Night Watch, we can blame film spotting listeners. That's
right.
Good.
Night
okay.
Watch, well, we'll have to blame Cinecast listeners.
All right.
Night Watch narrowly
edged out.
Much more
sophisticated out. Film spotting listeners.
I guess so. It narrowly edged out.
It's right.
Dave
and
Chappelle's
I've been meaning to catch up on it. And it wasn't a time, unfortunately, where we could unfortunately see both films.
Yeah, we just couldn't.
But this is a great reminder to just catch it on DVD.
It is, and I think Sam and I are, despite being really white, are actually into hip-hop somewhat, and I have to point out that she mentions Common. Common was recently on an edition of Sound Opinions, which is a Chicago Public Radio production. It actually is the show that's
immediately
on
proceeds.
Right before us on Saturday nights when we're on public radio. And this show recently, go to the podcast, they have it in iTunes or whatever, you'll find it if you do a Google search. They had a recent show with Common on where he does a version of one of the songs off his new album, B. I think the song is called The Queen Pin, I believe. And then he also does like a 5-minute, totally improvisational. They start the music and he just goes. And it really is one of the most mind-blowing pieces of radio I've ever heard.
It really is incredible.
It's
Common,
amazing.
Common, of course, is Chicago.
Bass rapper, raps a lot with Kanye, produced his album. Go check it out.
Seriously.
And now we'll go back to sounding really white as if that wasn't enough of that. Okay. This one from Matt, who says, I have one recommendation for top five of the year so far that didn't make it into your discussion. Michael Winterbottom's Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story was a delight both times I saw it in the theater. It would easily top my list of best ensemble film of the year so far. And he praises Steve Coogan's performance as well in that. And Sam, we bring this up because liked it more than you.
I did, but it's honestly, of all the films that are on the list that didn't make my top five, I think I assigned it 3 stars on our blog. It's the film I kind of want to go back and see the most. I mean, and mostly that has to do with Steve Coogan's performance, but also Rob Brydon. I mean, I think how many times have I just thought of simply wanting to get the DVD so I could see them do their Pacino impressions.
Exactly.
I mean, there's so much to like about this. Peter Labuza from St. Paul, Minnesota writes about, when I think about which performance I got the most out of, this is it. And I think we can agree. I was honestly surprised he didn't. I was sort of not putting him on my top five best performances of the year so far because I was convinced you would.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a film I loved, but
I told you later, actually, Tristram Shandy was probably number 6 on my list of best movies of the year, and Steve Coogan's performance was probably number 6 on my list of male performances. So it's right up there. We wanted to acknowledge that I did consider that strongly for my list.
And for me, too. I think it's one of these films that, like, just my expectations were so high. Michael Winterbottom, a favorite director of mine, and it's like the fact that it didn't quite live up to expectations, probably looking back on it, if I were to see it again, probably much better than so many of the films I like this year.
This one from CJ Simonson, he says, my list, Friends with Money, number 5, number 4, X-Men 3, number 3, Cars, number 2, Thank You for Smoking, and number 1, our movie that we had is our number 1, Brick. But an interesting choice there to see X-Men that high. Interesting choice for me to see Cars that high. Of course, dope sheet readers will know that I recently gave a mini review of that movie, and I actually wasn't taken with it as I was with previous Pixar movies. But number 5, Friends with Money, we wanted to just mention that you did see this movie.
I did see the movie, and because it is a film that a lot of listeners have written in about, and it's a film that I will discuss briefly on the dope sheet this week, the film spotting email blast, so I'll get into that. But it's a film that I'll get into on the email.
Yes, you will. So if you want to hear what Sam has to say about Friends with Money, we're pushing you to go to filmspotting.net, sign up for the email.
I know
email.
People, you're just chomping at the bit.
You're dying to know what he thinks about it. Hey, it's got your favorite actor, your favorite actress in it,
Kathy Keener. Yeah.
Yeah. Kathy. You can call her Kathy now.
Kat Keener.
Okay, well, let's end on this one from Jim Briggs.
Jim's top 5 movies of the year are Thank You for Smoking, Inside Man, Brick, and number 1, United 93. And if you're counting, that is, of course, the only top 4 of the year so far.
Uh-huh.
But Jim writes, I saw both United 93 and Brick with the same friend, and after Brick, We couldn't stop talking about it, but after 93, we didn't say a word to each other. That's what edged it out. What a film.
I think,
we couldn't agree more with the fact that you walk out of that film and United 93, it wasn't a film I liked as much as you did, but you can't help but, you know, the impact of that film
exactly.
is tremendous.
And I just thought that was a good point to end on there, Jim. Nicely put. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Betty Davis said, I found this today, Sam, acting should be bigger than life. Script should be bigger than life. It should all be bigger than life. But we're going to take a few minutes here to give some love to the small actors, the subtle ones, the character actors.
I like it.
Our top five character actors who should be in every movie is up next. Stay with us.
Tenderly, tenderly, please take my breath from me into the fountain seen up from the ground. Cheerfully, joyfully, burn what is left of me. I don't want these burdens that hands on me. You be my guest, and I'll let you stay. Leave me the check, I'll pay with the rest of my life.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and it's time to get into our top five for this week, inspired by a recent Onion article, top five character actors who should be in every movie. And our criteria, we just want to go over this real quick again for people that may not have heard Wednesday's show. You had a great list here, Sam, that were your guidelines. You said they can't be a household name to most people. They're so good, you actually want the movie to slow down so they can be in it longer. And lastly, they make big, bold choices that if they don't always work, they are at least memorable. We also left out some that were kind of in our pantheon. People that we think are maybe a little too big for the list. Alec Baldwin, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Christopher Walken, Don Cheadle, Paul Giamatti, and William H. Macy. It's now time to hear the top five.
My desert island. All time. Top five most memorable breakups.
Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s go.
Sub question. Is it in fact unfair to criticize a formerly great artist for his latter-day sins? Is it better to burn out than to fade away?
Top five side ones. Track ones.
All right, Adam, before we get to your number five, let's quickly go over your six through ten. You had William Fichtner, Dennis Farina, Brian Cox, Tilda Swinton, and Zooey Deschanel. And you're number five.
This totally throws everything off, Sam, me going first.
I don't like it. It feels weird. I don't know if Film Spotting listeners are aware of, or if something sounds strange, it's because Adam's going first to top
I'm
five.
Completely
it's never
thrown
been
off
done
my
before.
Game here. My number five, and before I say it, I just want to set up two other kind of guidelines I use, and I mentioned both of them on Wednesday's show, that these are all actors who also can be kind of chameleons. They play very different roles from film to film, which is kind of the definition of a character actor. They never play themselves or one person, but they really are different from movie to movie. And lastly, they tend to make bad material better. So with that in mind, my number five is a guy I know you like as well from one of your favorite movies you love to bring up, Safe Men, an overlooked movie, and that is Sam Rockwell. I think of Sam Rockwell as a guy who's just someone at the party who everyone wants to hang out with. If you're at a party with Sam Rockwell, you'd want to be in the room with him because he's just such a fun-loving, good-natured, funny guy with tons of charisma. You want to be around him. And again, this idea of bad material better, I had to see Charlie's Angels. I've brought this up before. I reviewed it. So I had to sit through Charlie's Angels, a really terrible movie, but he plays the bad guy in that movie, and he's having so much fun doing it that his natural kind of energy actually made me enjoy every part he was on screen in an otherwise dismal movie. So I have to single him out for that. But I also have to mention movies that he makes big choices in, like The Green Mile. He's also good in Galaxy Quest. He's good in Heist. He's good in, of course, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, playing Chuck Barris, where he's the star. And, of course, I do also like him in Matchstick Men, the Ridley Scott film. And lastly, I have to mention Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a movie you loved.
Loved.
I only mildly liked, but he makes a huge, bold choice there to basically be a version
George
of George
Bush
W. Bush
space,
in outer space. So I give him credit for that. All right. Well, before we do your number five, Sam, we got to give your six through ten. You had Mary Lynn Ryskub from Punch Drunk Love, memorably, among other things, Louise Guzman, Allison Janney, Tony Shalhoub, and Dennis Farina.
I love it out here. This is what I want. Does it count for something? Back home, I'd be working some nowhere job. Nobody even know I was alive. We burn the fat off our souls. Hemingway, he said that.
All right, that's my number five, Peter Sarsgaard as Troy in Jarhead, a film that you said your criteria was they make a bad film better. I think he makes not a very good film, at least more interesting in terms of his choice. And I think, honestly, Sarsgaard's one of these actors I can only declare a character actor for the time being. I don't think he's going to be refined to, I don't know if some people would perceive it as the character actor Get Out for Long. He has the kind of charisma, a lot of people compare him to John Malkovich, that demands kind of bigger parts. And I think those will be forthcoming. But for the time being, he's great as the kind of emotionally wounded loner, as he is so good as Mark in Garden State, in Boys Don't Cry, making his first impression on me, certainly, and then in Shattered Glass, too, as well, where he received a lot of acclaim for that performance. It remains to be seen whether he has the same kind of oddball theatrical instincts that Malkovich has, because certainly there's a lot of similarities to them in terms of the menace they bring to just about every performance. And we'll see about that. But for the time being, he's really just an interesting character actor in a lot of these, you know, parts that, would somebody else might not make so interesting.
I agree. Great choice. My number four is David Morse. And I actually really wanted to put him higher on the list because I really do feel like he needs more attention. He doesn't get nearly enough. He's a guy who I think of as always being sort of tortured, and yet a guy who can play characters as we've seen. He was, for example, good in a bad movie, 16 Blocks.
Right.
He made that character a lot of fun playing a bad guy, but again, adding some subtlety to it, adding some shades to it. And then you've got him being a good guy, but in a really bad role, actually, I'll say, Down in the Valley. He plays Evan Rachel Wood's father in that film, and we'll review that movie a little bit later. But he's also in The Green Mile. He's in The Crossing Guard, the Jack Nicholson movie with Sean Penn that directed that. And I think of him as just a guy when he's not playing a bad guy, which he is in The Negotiator and in 16 Blocks. He pulls that off great, but he also can be that guy who you kind of think of as your best friend. He's just a guy who's never going to let you down. And when you see him appear on screen, you get a comfortable feeling like, oh, I know everything's in good hands because David Morse is here. And that's certainly the way I felt about a movie like Hearts in Atlantis, is a movie I actually kind of liked. And he shows up just at the end as the older version of the main character. And it somehow just everything feels right when he shows up on screen. So it's my number four.
It's a great point. I love David Morse as well. My number four, maybe my earliest perception of like somebody that I wanted to be in every movie, and that's Catherine O'Hara. Really most famous recently for Christopher Guest films. If you're going to see any Catherine O'Hara performance, pick a Christopher Guest film and she's going to be brilliant in it. But I think with Catherine O'Hara, there's something about her understanding of the inherent absurdity of her character. She doesn't make huge choices. And sometimes she's saddled with these sort of best friend of the lead kind of, or she was certainly in the late 80s, early 90s, but she never overplays it. She never makes these kind of big, bold choices that I referred to as part of my criteria, but there's a quirky slant to every one of her characters that immediately makes them compelling and funny. And I think it's just a matter of her trusting how funny she is just in her delivery. And I think it's what makes her so memorable and unique.
Yeah, she's fantastic without a doubt. My number three is Chris Cooper. And I have to say with my last three here, I really did feel, I told you this before we started recording, that I felt a little bad that it didn't have more names on it like David Morse and even Sam Rockwell that were more unknown. I think these three guys are all kind of crossing into that territory when you're Chris Cooper and you're getting Oscar nominations and people are aware of you.
And
winner for adaptation. I believe it was adaptation, was it not?
It was,
He certainly deserved it. He would have got my vote that year. I thought he was great in that role. But he's a guy who I still feel probably is a guy most people go, oh, he's a that guy.
Yeah.
You recognize him. You know right. who he is. You've seen him in a lot of things, but you don't know his name yet. And I think he's that good that everyone should. Again, making bad material better. I think Seabiscuit is a decidedly average film. And yet him and Jeff Bridges, there are scenes in that film that actually hit you on an emotional level. His relationship with that horse and just everything about that character, it's all because Chris Cooper brings such an integrity
totally
to it. He's also great as the bad guy in The Bourne Identity. He's brilliant, as I mentioned, in Adaptation. I like him in American Beauty and in October Sky, playing, again, this kind of bad dad in a way, a guy who is the kind of the evil dad who wants his son to work in the coal mine. But again, there are so many shades of goodness to him. And then you also get into the John Sayles films. This is where most people discovered him. The lead in Mate One, he's in City of Hope. And of course, the one where I really discovered him was Lone Star, seeing him in that as Buddy Deeds' son. Just a breakthrough performance. And I think that he's fantastic in every Sayles film. And I love Chris Cooper in just about anything.
The last act makes a film. Wow them in the end, you got a hit. You can have flaws, problems, but wow them in the end, and you've got a hit. Find an ending, but don't cheat, and don't you dare bring in a deus ex machina.
All right, you just heard Brian Cox as real-life screenplay teacher Robert McKee in Adaptation. Adaptation is all over this list. You just mentioned Chris Cooper, of course, as well. And, of course, Brian Cox was in your 6 through 10 earlier in the week. And there's something about Brian Cox and his... I remember reading an interview with Robert McKee about... And he actually had something to do with the casting of the actor who was going to play him in Adaptation. And he's the one that picked Brian
They're
Cox.
They're friends.
Yeah, and it was because... And this is what I'll always remember, is that... He described Brian Cox as somebody who never demands to be liked. He never tries to be liked. There's, you know, it makes you realize how many actors get by just on their charm in some way. And Brian Cox is just, he never overplays villainy, but he just always sort of justifies it in some way. I mean, he's just like, and I'm most memorably, only because I saw it recently, was in X-Men 2. I mean, there's something about, there's a realism with which he portrays like outright villainy that brings a kind of realism to even these most outrageous plots. And that's why he works so well in films like, you know, X-Men 2 or The Bourne Supremacy or something like that. And these are far-fetched premises in these thrillers and sci-fi films. And yet his performance in these villainous roles in some way brings them down to earth and in a kind of reality, which makes buying into them so much easier. And I think that's largely credit to him.
That's not an MP. That's a YP. Your problem. Come up with the money and I'll give you the tapes. That's it.
Okay. All right, now you're talking above my head, all right? I don't know this industry jargon, YP, MP, whatever, okay? All I know is that I cannot get a record contract. We cannot get a record contract unless I take these tapes. And granted, the tapes themselves you own them, okay?
That's a clip there from my number two, of course, John C. Reilly. And we almost put him into that pantheon, Sam. Yeah. And he probably deserves to be there. But again, I feel like he's a guy who doesn't get enough credit. He's that good, even though he did get an Oscar nomination, a deserved
one.
For Chicago, he's really good in that. But I have to single him out some more. You hear that great clip from Boogie Nights, how hilarious he is as Reed Rothschild. And then also we praised him recently in A Prairie Home Companion with Woody Harrelson. He's in Magnolia, another great performance in a very good Paul Thomas Anderson film. And he brings also something to a movie like The Hours, even though he's in it for a brief amount of time. The Perfect Storm, The Good Girl, Heart 8, which is kind of a lead role for him a little bit, but he's awesome in that film. And even we get back to this idea of bold choices, Dark Water, a film we both liked from last year where he plays like the most evil landlord ever, and yet there's nothing about him. It's not evil so much as just sleaze. He just really personifies sleaze in a way you haven't really seen in a film before. He's really good in it, and of course, coming out, Talladega Nights, Will Ferrell's sidekick.
We can't wait.
We cannot wait for it. This, the new trailer, the second one, you just finally saw it. Is hilarious.
Peanut Butter and Ladies.
Peanut
Can't
Butter
wait.
And Ladies. That's right. That's John C. Reilly all over it. That's my number two.
I love the pick. I have to say, like, I really excluded people that had even been nominated for an Oscar. I mean, nobody
That's
on
fair.
My list.
That's totally fair.
My number two, again, you already mentioned him, but it is Sam Rockwell. And I have this in my notes. It's uncanny the way you described him. The fact is, you just like being around him. He makes really bold choices. Certainly, I think of Zaphod Beeblebrox in Hitchhiker's Guide. And he's just got this goofy innocence about him. Somebody that would have definitely appeared on my list 5 years ago, Steve Zahn. Where have you gone, Steve Zahn, other than to the jungle
with
Werner Herzog and Christian Bale? Apparently, we could look forward to that sometime later this year or next year. But for me, it really is how much he gets by on his charm, but also how directors and how he uses that fact to kind of subvert our expectations. I think most interestingly, you mentioned it in Matchstick Men, where really I think part of the surprise of that film is the fact that we have a certain expectation about a Sam Rockwell performance, particularly in that role as a kind of goofy dimwit. Mm-hmm. And then really he sort of takes us on that ride. Yeah. And it's like, but I think most importantly, it is a matter of just the fact that, like you said, if he's at the party, he's the guy you want to be around. And the fact that, you know, he can make that an interesting choice in some way, all the power to him.
McManus. He told us another story altogether.
Oh, is that the one about the hookup with a dysentery? I say, he'll flip you.
He'll what?
Flip you. Flip you for real.
You like baseball?
Claro.
When he likes what he barks, so kids can play at night. So it's safe.
so they can play baseball. So they don't become burros para los malones.
Just a brief montage I put together there for my number one. You can't get much bolder than the choice Benicio del Toro makes in The Usual Suspects.
Another Oscar winner.
Yes, another Oscar winner. I know. I'm telling you I feel bad, but really, Sam, when it gets down to it, I thought of those actors that I really respect and who I do truly want to see in every film.
Absolutely.
And he's a guy who makes my list. And you've got him in The Usual Suspects, shows up on set playing this character who nobody can understand. And basically, Bryan Singer just decides to go along with it. And it ends up being one of the most memorable things about the film. It doesn't distract from the film, really. It ends up being an integral part of it and a hilarious part of it. And then you've got something like the subtlety of what you heard there in Traffic that he brings to that character, that disillusioned cop, the cop with integrity in a disingenuous world, really. And he's so brilliant in that role as well. I always feel like Del Toro is bringing complexity to his roles, that he's always hiding something, even when he's playing good people or seemingly happy people. And you think of him improving material. I'm not a huge fan of Terry Gilliam's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but he's so fun to watch as, of course, Hunter Thompson's lawyer in that, and he's great in 21 Grams, another film I didn't enjoy as much as you did, The Pledge. He's in the movie The Pledge, the Sean Penn film, for only about 10 minutes, but it's riveting to watch his character there as someone wrongly accused of murder. The Way of the Gun, I love him in. He's great in Snatch. And, of course, making another big choice, bold choice, as Jackie Boy from Sin City, Sam's favorite
My
movie.
My favorite film of all time.
Benicio del Toro is an actor I love, is someone I would genuinely love to see in every film.
Absolutely, and a kind of criteria, too, I think would apply to Benicio del Toro, and also to somebody like Sam Rockwell, you know, that the movie is automatically more interesting with them in it. You're going to go see it, because they're in it, largely. But my number one, and this is the one where I feel like, here's the greatest actor who's just one part away from making the leap. Suddenly everyone will know his name and he's handed every award that's deserved to him, and it is Jeffrey Wright. Who's brilliant, of course, recently in Syriana and Broken Flowers last year. He's amazing, really. If there's no other reason to see Ali, it's his performance, and he's probably in 10 or so minutes or less, but really it's, there's something just almost kind of magical. He's got this, he brings a kind of intelligence and integrity that's never showy and so specific to every character. And I think about like the actor's maxim that even if your character is the most villainous character on earth, you as the actor have to come to like or sympathize with the character. And I feel like nobody does that better than Jeffrey Wright, who seems to like uncannily understand his characters that he's portraying. And if you're going to see one movie, and I know this is the movie, there's probably not a more seriously flawed film.
You're bringing up Shaft, aren't you?
that has not only great character actors, but also great performances by great character actors. And it is, yes, John Singleton's Shaft. I mean, seriously.
It's a bad film.
It's a bad film, but with Jeffrey Wright as Peoples Hernandez, Christian Bale, Dan Hedaya, Tony Collette, honestly, quite possibly the worst movie with the most great performances and by an overqualified cast. And so it's not something you have to rent because you know it's on like TNT or whatever, you know, any night of the week. So just make sure you don't flip the channels. Wait for Jeffrey Wright to get on screen and watch his magic.
I really do feel shame, Sam. I have to say, in all my research, I've got like 50 names I'm upset I left off and I completely overlooked.
How could you?
Jeffrey Wright. I don't know how I could. Okay. Well, that is our top five. That is the show. Send feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. Send us your top five or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening in wide release this weekend, The Devil Wears Prada with Meryl Streep, and opened on Wednesday, Superman Returns. Hear our review of Superman Returns and our top five movie scores.
You can also check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and much more at filmspotting.net, and help us reach new listeners by voting for us at Podcast Alley. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Saturday, July 1st will be a new month. Please go and vote. Also on our blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast.
Thanks to Nico Case and Bloodshot Records for today's music. Please check her out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Hallgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
scenes in the preview of, you know, Jack Black and his beloved nun, and Carcion. What's
her name? Encarnacion.
His beloved nun and
His beloved nun.
It was
Encarnacion.
And his beloved nun and his beloved nun's sister, Encarnacion.